Okay, the committee come to order on the 26th of February. First off, Representative Fabian makes a motion to approve the February 20th meeting minutes. Any additions or corrections? Being none, Representative Fabian renews his motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Minutes are approved. The first bill to come for us today is House File 461. It's a Benson bill. Representative Benson moves that the House File 461 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Government Operations. Representative Benson, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So we've moved that, and I also have a delete all amendment, Mr. Chair, which is DE1.
Okay, so Representative Benson moves to adopt the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author wishes. Any questions on the DE1 amendment? Being none, all in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 461 is amended with the DE1. We are on the bill as amended. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman of the committee, I'm here to assist a number of constituent homeowners who continue to face the dilatory effects on their shared properties caused by an uncontrolled invasion of hybrid invasive plant species, in this case, a hybridized Eurasian narrowleaf cattail that is rapidly degrading the viability of what had been a pristine lake in my district here in Hennepin County. And I've been working for a considerable length of time with the DNR, principally Mr. Myers, in order to try to meet the needs of my constituents while also responding to the concerns of the DNR. Now, I'm sure that other lakeshore property owners throughout the state are facing a similar challenge, but this very narrowly written bill and delete all amendment that I have before the committee today is designed to take care of a specific problem in my house district. But I, Mr. Chairman, pledge to continue to work with the DNR to better craft a proposal as it moves to government operations if that seems to be needed. Now, some specifics about this bill before I ask my testifier, Mr. Peter Davis, who is the president of the Shavers Lake Preservation Association, to more clearly discuss the issues that this narrowly drawn bill is attempting to rectify. Number one, Shavers Lake has no public access, and all the shoreline and lake bottom is owned by private owners, homeowners. And also in 1983, the DNR had granted a general use permit to the Shavers Lake homeowners to mechanically harvest the hybridized cattails. And today we're basically seeking a similar permit, asking the DNR to permit the homeowners at their own expense to control this invasive hybrid species. Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to ask Mr. Davies to present his testimony. I believe he also has a handout, which maybe someone can help us with.
Thank you very much to our Page for his continuing good work in this committee. And Mr. Davies?
Davis.
Oh, Davis. Davis. All right, Mr. Davis, will you tell us who you are, who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of this committee. My name is Peter Davis. I'm a resident and live on Shavers Lake. I am the president of the Shavers Lake Preservation Association, an association that was established actually back in 1986, actually as a precursor to a lot of the work that was going on in the lake that I'll describe to you in a minute. While our plight as a lake is not unique by any stretch, I'm told our circumstances certainly are, and the fact that we've taken Herculean efforts to prevent the lake from being turned into a marsh back in the early 80s. So I've provided in this little background some statement of facts around the lake, about the lake. We're nestled down in a bowl. Representative Benson talked about the fact that we have only water coming in from public storm sewers, no outlets. We're kind of our own little watershed. And most of the residents are all violently in agreement about proactively managing to keep this really neat little resource and ecosystem a lake rather than a cattail marsh. If you are getting the package, if you flip to page 4 very quickly, I want to use a couple pictures to describe you what happened back in the 80s.
One moment, please. Mr. Davis, you said a moment ago public storm sewers. Did you mean public storm drains?
Storm drains.
Thank you.
Yes, we have unfiltered stormwater runoff coming into the lake, which is one of our few sources of supply. But that's another contributing factor to what's happening with the cattails. If you look on page 4, back in the late 80s, on the left-hand side, you can see in the early 80s, the picture is looking to the north on the east basin of the lake. That corner, on the upper left corner of that first picture, is actually an area that where my shoreline is. If you look on the right side of that picture, you can see nice clean water. This is after the DNR project was approved and efforts were made to remove all of the cattails. The 1983 permit that Representative Benson mentioned, which is this permit, gave us the ability to mechanically cut and pull, and we removed all the cut vegetation around the entire lake. This was almost unheard of back then. Now, what's interesting about what happened is because we were quickly losing the lake. This is before actually I even moved onto the lake. But on page 5, if you look at that same picture and look where our shoreline is, I compared it with what's happened in 2011, and you'll see this incredible weed growth that, in fact, prevents us from even getting down to the lake anymore from a recreational perspective in the summertime. So this body of water is having these same weeds come back, and they're growing just as quickly, if not more quickly. And in the span of, you know, less than 30 years, we're back to where we were back in 1982. So if you look on page 6, this was a picture looking at that east basin again, and you can see the cattail growth that's gone pretty much unabated until, and this picture is from 2011. What's happening to us is because of incredible sediment buildup, we're in a low water period. I've been actively managing the lake on behalf of a number of my neighbors for the last 15 years. We're seeing these cattails growing faster and faster, and whereas we're now in a low water period, that muck, the cattails love that nutrient-rich muck, which has been building up because of all the other invasive species that every year decompose and build up this, you know, unfiltered biomass. So we're asking for some help because this is no different than the purple loosestrife that we controlled back decades ago as well, and we'd like to be able to manage our lake. Could I answer any questions for you?
Members. Representative Bouguinas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am guessing this narrow leaf cattail is a non-native and is supplanting natives.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Bouguinas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be interesting to hear what the science is of getting rid of these because they are crowding out the natives, and the natives are good. So if you get rid of them, cut them down, unless you establish something else, they will come back. Do you have an establishment plan to establish a vegetation that can essentially keep them from coming back?
Mr.
I mean,
Davis,
that's the normal thing.
Yes, if you look at if you look at page 4 on that right picture, you can see what the lake looked like very quickly after all of this biomass, these cattails, were pushed up onto the shore above the ordinary high water mark and left to decompose. What happened in the ensuing years is because of limitations and policy on us, we were not able to actually control the growth of these cattails because it's prohibited by the DNR, with the exception of a 15-foot channel to get down to the lake or some yardage out in front of your dock. So we had to sit back and watch them reestablish themselves, which is now preventing us from using the lake on a recreational basis. And on our website during the summer months, we have to actually declare it's now a safety and health hazard because of the growth and because of what's going on in the bottom. So it's a matter really of what we were planning to do was no different than what was done in 83, which is mechanically using some excavating equipment is peel all of this layer of weeds and put them right back up on shore, let that become a berm, in effect, that becomes a source of filtration in and of itself, and then let history start to repeat itself. We just want to be able to actively control them, because when I first started, when I moved to the lake, for example, we do a lot of, I'm the rink master for our neighborhood as well, and our rink was nicely tucked up into that shoreline, and right now, if you came out and saw an aerial photograph, you'd see our rink is practically in the middle of the lake now, because of all the cattails. So we're just looking to basically solve our problem again in a pretty Herculean effort, and then have the ability to ongoing keep them from, because they'll reroute. You can't get rid of those seeds. They're going to keep coming back. We just want to be able to control them.
Well, Mr. Davis, I didn't hear you say it, to answer the question of Representative Bouguinas about did you intend then to plant native species?
Yes, that's been part of our plan all along, along with other native grasses that create this polymorphic, you know, buffer area in the front. But we're not opposed to having cattails. We like the look of the cattails. We like 10 feet of them. We just don't want 100 feet or actually just lose the lake to them. Our plight right now is that without some efforts, we're going to lose the lake. The lake will become a cattail marsh probably in less than a decade. And we're at that tipping point.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be helpful to hear from some science about what you do when you have this problem, because I'm guessing this is not unique to this lake. And are there things that, if you harvest them, I feel like you do need to put something back in if you're going to have any hope of keeping the lake. I mean, that's just...
Well, I think, Representative Bouguinas, we are going to hear from the DNR. I don't know at what level they're going to testify on the bill as now amended. So further questions, Representative Ugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question. Since 1961, your handout says Minnetonka, Deep Haven constructed stormwater runoff drains. These question is, do they drain directly into the lake?
Yes, sir.
And
Mr. Chair,
in today's engineering and everything else for these things, there's NERP ponds that are designed to control the runoff of sediment that goes into your final lake and drainage system. There are no, I'm assuming there are no NERP ponds that were designed back in 61.
Mr. Chair? No, sir. These are all unfiltered storm water run, inlets.
Mr. Chair? So, help me here. I'm thinking that really that this inferior design that occurred in 1961 has contributed greatly to the degradation of the lake. If things would have been engineered correctly back then, you probably wouldn't have a problem today. Is that a fair assumption?
David.
Mr. Chair, it's certainly a contributing factor, but not the only factor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Davis, Representative Benson, thanks for being here. I'm curious, you made one statement. You said that you've been actively managing the lake. Can you explain to me what that, you, for your neighbors, can you give me some insight as to what you mean by that?
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fabian, actively managing is within all of the DNR policy constraints regarding aquatic control permits, things we can do in the water for both submergent weeds, emergent weeds. We've tried to do everything we can to try to keep the lake a lake. And what's happening to us right now is that we cannot, under the current policies, control these narrow leaf cattails because they're outstripping our ability to control them.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Davis, just to follow up, when I look at the pictures on page 4, and then you fast forward from the late 80s after removal, and then you go at some point, I mean, Representative Wagenius, I understand her concern about what she's talking about, but what was the condition of the lake, I mean, in terms of recreation, in terms of maybe fish that were there, aquatic animals and so forth that inhabited the lake after that? And then what's it like now or back then when it was so largely infested?
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fabian, we enjoy a rich ecosystem of all sorts of wildlife, including fish. I've been told by stories anecdotally that when the train from Minneapolis ran out to Excelsior, the kids at the other end of the lake would sell minnows to people on the trolleys that were going out to Lake Minnetonka. That dates back a long time. We've had active muskrat populations that have helped us with cattail control over the years, but these populations come and go, just as our minnow population has come and gone. The fishery itself has been in a fairly consistent state of decline as the sediment buildup has now essentially created enough toxins in the lake that we have had serious fish kills in a few winters. When I talk about active management, the lake, because of dissolved oxygen levels, we actually took up a collection and installed, with the state's permission, aspirators to blow air into the lake. And these are all the kinds of things that you do when you have a small body of water. It's kind of like a swimming pool. You figure out what will work, and you go for it.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Davis, what's the maximum depth of the lake? I'd be interested to see a topographical map of the lake just to get some sort of a feel for what I consider to be some potential for the lake.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fabian, the lake depth, as I understood it, was 15 to 18 feet at its deepest point. Its average depth today is 2 feet in terms of that's how much sediment buildup we've had.
Questions from other members? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Benson, I think you're breaking the seal on a big bottle here. This is a huge issue. Most metro, I just think of my district, and I can think of 2 or 3 or 4 lakes that are similar to that, where you have sedimentation and cattails. So a couple questions. The general aquatic permit, is that just a mechanical permit, or is it a herbicide permit, too?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, it is a mechanical permit, and it's purposely restricted to this particular lake. And the reason I'm doing it is there are substantial questions about the effect of a general purpose permit that would encompass the metropolitan area or the entire state, and the impacts that would have on the DNR and statutory requirements that if an item is specifically designated as an invasive species, this is a hybridized species, then the DNR would be faced with substantial expense and effort and an attempt to eradicate a species, which is, in the metropolitan area at least, out of control. This is something, you know, that should have been dealt with decades ago and was not, for whatever reason. We can blame some previous legislature who didn't fund the DNR adequately, maybe. The issue having to do with this lake, I narrowed it just to one specific thing. There are other issues concerning, you know, the viability of this lake, which we could come back to at a future date. But right now, we're simply asking that the DNR grant a general use permit to mechanically harvest or remove this hybridized invasive species in this particular lake.
Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Davis, maybe I missed this, but how big is the lake? How many acres?
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Fabian, I think it depends on what year you're talking about. It goes anywhere between 15 acres of water to 22 acres is what officially I've heard. We still don't really know how many acres of water we have right now.
What, Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope my final question. Obviously, you're trying to deal with the cattail issue now, but if the lake at one time was 15, 18 feet deep, and now you're telling me it's 2 feet deep?
On average, yes.
On average. What's the maximum depth of the lake that you know of?
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fabian, the same spot where we recorded 15 to 18 feet probably right now is about 6 feet of open water before you would hit that heavy pack muck.
Questions from members? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Benson, would the mechanical control be done by each of the landowners, or would you be contracting someone?
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Davis probably should answer that, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair.
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hansen, this work would be a combination of both efforts by the association and individual homeowners. It would be done in conjunction with approval of each of the homeowners relative to what they'd like to see for the amount of cattails. And it would start even effectively this winter yet, because one of the first things you do is you shave the cattails down to the ice, you cover them with water, you let them drown, and then they become much easier in the spring to be able to pull the root structures out. So that's essentially the approach. It's a multi-step, multi-year program to be able to do this, because we're on such a limited operating budget.
Further questions? All right, so let's hear from the DNR. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you.
I want to say something while Mr. Peterson's coming up. Welcome, Mr. Peterson. The enactment date, since it's not specified in this bill, would be August if it were adopted. So I want to dispel any thoughts that this would be something that get accomplished this year. And even if we did have an enactment date of day of enacted, you know, that could be well past any ice season around here. So I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page on that one. I mean, I understand what he said, but I want to make sure that we all understand it. Okay, Mr. Peterson, welcome. Introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dirk Peterson. I'm the fisheries chief of Minnesota DNR. And just for clarification, in the world of aquatic plant management, we operate the permit program for work in nearshore areas. They're critical to the lake's ecology, and they're also fundamental fish habitat as well as other aquatic life. And I believe you're each being handed a short handout that was to address the original bill that was proposed, but it has good application to the modified bill that you have in front of you. Just to give a little primer on some aspects of why we are concerned about the removal of more than, well, first of all, let me talk briefly about what the aquatic permit program does. It serves two functions. One is every riparian landowner has a reasonable right to gain access to open water. And number two, we have a responsibility to protect aquatic vegetation and those nearshore habitats for the benefits of all Minnesotans. So to that extent, in emergent vegetation, it's an incredibly valuable component of the lake's system and the nearshore component. If you look at the back, there's a stylized diagram from one of our publications that's been clipped out for you. And it basically just shows the different aquatic plant zones that are present in a lake. And emergent plants are very valuable in preventing shoreland erosion, and therefore we find them to be very valuable. If you flip it back to the front page, you'll see an example here on a lake. I'm not exactly sure which lake this is, but you can see where emergent vegetation is in place, even in its dead form, relative to a place where it's been removed. And this is just an example of the sort of shoreline erosion problems that can occur when you remove excessive amounts of emergent vegetation like cattails and bulrush. Now, our permit program, to address its dual purpose of access and protection of habitat, will issue a permit. We do a first-time inspection of a 15-foot boat channel so that landowner can have reasonable access to open water. If it's wider than that, we'll make a site judgment, but typically 15 feet is pro forma. We handle that quite nicely with most landowners. That is the standard. If you get to the submerged vegetation component, they can do up to 2,500 square feet of submerged control without a permit. If they want to use chemicals, then we require a permit. And so those two things give the landowner reasonable use of their lakeshore, potentially a swimming beach or a wading area, and also a channel out to the open water that they can use their boat and align their dock. So with that context, to provide a broad general permit that would give a landowner the right to remove most of the, if not all of the aquatic emergent vegetation along their shoreline could have problems on Shaver Lake as well as any other lake that it might be applied to. And so, anyway, that's the rationale here. Now, we understand that they have excessive nutrient and maybe sediment loading to this lake. It's already been described in the questioning of the committee that that's a storm sewer problem that's probably come from past urban planning that's not up to date to current standards. And cattails often like nutrient-rich environments. But even so, these narrow-leaf cattails, although there's a lot of conjecture in the literature as to whether they're invasive or not, we do not class them that way in Minnesota law. Secondly, the native cattail that we're most familiar with is the broadleaf cattail. In a replacement plan, if you were to try and plant native broadleaf cattail, we do not have much science, let alone background or experience, with that being highly successful. And on top of that, broadleaf cattails will hybridize with the narrow-leaf cattail. So on a lot-by-lot basis around the lake, that could be problematic as far as trying to do any sort of restoration. Your typical desirable bulrushes, which is another emergent plant that you see desirable for fishing and is offshore habitat when you're in your lake home, that usually requires, some species require hard bottoms, and obviously this site is relatively soft bottoms. Now, historically, permits have been issued by the department for homeowners on Shavers Lake to actually address their access and use of the lake needs. And the most recent permit was one that we issued in 2012, where our aquatic plant management specialist went out and worked with a little over 35 riparian landowners and developed a plan where each one had their boating access to open water. They each had their 2,500 square feet of submerged control. And then we allowed, I think it's up to 20% or 5 acres, whichever is less, of a basin to be treated to allow for an open water area for use. The lake has two lobes, and that sort of treatment was allowed on the two lobes, and we granted a channel through the cattails to adjoin both lobes. It seemed to me a fair plan that addressed all the needs of the rule that are designed to protect nearshore habitats and still provide riparian access to the water. So I think the permit program works. It's responsive to the people of places like Shavers Lake, and it also has broader important erosion control factors for this lake as well as others, and we find that emergent vegetation is necessary and valuable. So I could take some questions if you wish.
Question. Mr. Davis, I have a question.
Munbeck.
Welcome again, sir. Why doesn't this work?
Mr. Chair, why doesn't what work?
What his permit process. Why are you here wanting to do this when he says he has a permit process that works?
Mr. Chair, I'm looking forward to actually introducing myself to Mr. Peterson here. He's absolutely correct when he talked about the fact that we did work with one of his area supervisors. The number wasn't 35. There were a number of homeowners that were turned down in the permitting application process. The circumstances of the size of our lake really don't lend itself to the kind of control that we need in order to keep the lake from becoming a cattail marsh. So it's one thing for me to have a channel, but that channel is only good for a couple aspects of the kind of control we're looking to do, which is allowing this cattail growth to just keep running straight out into the middle of the lake. So we don't have really qualms with it. There are other issues that I'll be probably addressing with Mr. Peterson at some point regarding chemical control application periods and the like that just have made it more difficult to do things. But that aside, the real issue before us is this plant is continuing to just run on its own course, and all we want to be able to do is control it so that we maintain a healthy lake and ultimately a healthy lake bottom, and that will help all of the birds, wildlife, fishery, everything that goes on, and all of the other, you know, ancillary benefactors of this of the ecosystem.
Just another invasive. All right, thank you, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Davis, or anybody, was there ever any wild rice there? There's, you know, wild rice grows in hard bottom, soft bottom. Anybody's knowledge on that? It used to be pretty prevalent in southern Minnesota, I know.
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chair, just to correct the fact, and Mr. Purcell, no, to our knowledge, there's never been any wild rice at all. But I do want to add a fact to the record that says that Shavers Lake is also a hard bottom lake. You wouldn't know it because of all the muck, but it is, in fact, a sandy gravel bottom lake.
Representative Purcell.
Bring me to another question, then, because I know there's been, in some ecosystems, there's been hydro dredging done to help restore when there's been over sedimentation. Is that an option you've looked into and been denied or haven't looked into it?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Purcell, your question is suction dredging, I guess, is another term that's used. In fact, we made an application grant to the Minnehaha Watershed District in order to be able to do such a thing on our lake at our own expense. We've been discouraged from even thinking about that because we know that DNR's practices and policies don't really lend itself to giving people dredging permits. And we're also concerned right now about what might be happening with some of the, because of the unfiltered nature of the bottom, we may be in a situation we have elevated pHs, and we really don't know that yet either.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm a plant teacher, and it sounds to me, I mean, from what I'm hearing here, and Mr. Peterson, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds to me like the DNR wants this lake to become a cattail marsh.
Okay, well, that's not a question. That's an opinion, and I respect that opinion. So what I'm going to ask here is for Mr. Davis. I'm looking at page 4 of your handout, of the Davis handout, and I'm looking at the handout that Mr. Peterson handed out, and I'm looking at the back side. Actually, I'm not looking at that because I sent it up to you. Oh, Mrs. Harrison gave me a copy of it. So when I look at the picture on page 4, it says late 80s after removal, and then I look at the picture on the back of this, which was the department's handout. How much of the lake in the years following 1980 removal ended up looking like this, where you had this kind of sedimentation and erosion?
Mr. Chairman, we had zero.
And so I think this is perfect for me because I would pull a float plane right up on that. That's a perfect place. I would drive a float plane right on that. So if I was that homeowner, this would be the place for me. But I just was interested in that question. I think that that's an interesting statement. I'm thinking that there's the prospect that some of this could happen, but I think the fact that there was zero that happened from 1980s, whenever that exactly was, until today. I thank you for that answer. Questions by the members? Being none, Mr. Ness.
Mr. Chairman, the amendment is taking care of our concern.
Thank you very much. Okay, members, anyone else in the audience like to testify for or against the Benson bill? I do not see anyone. I am, now that the amendment was adopted, members, the bill does not have to go to government ops as it has been amended.
Very good.
Ms. Benson.
Would you like me? I'll just make a closing comment very briefly. First of all, Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you for the time you've granted us here. And just a couple of points to remember that this lake does not have public access. The management of the lake would be totally at the expense of homeowners. I'm a strong believer in property rights. The owners of this property own not only the lakeshore, but they also own the bottom of the lake as well. And to allow this lake to turn into a cattail marsh would be an enormous financial impact on the owners. We all know, and I own lake property, unfortunately, in another state, so I don't get there too often. But to I contributed a lot of money to a lake association. We worked very, very hard to keep affluence out of that lake, and we've been very successful. And so I am very sympathetic, David and his associates here. I think what they're proposing is eminently reasonable, fair. It should have been allowed years and years ago, and Mr. Chair and committee, I hope we can get your support.
Well, Representative Benson amends his motion for House File 461 as amended to be recommended to pass and referred directly to the General Register. All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Next item before us is House File 657 to be Representative Hackbarth will make the motion to lay over the bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Hackbarth, did you disappear? I thought I just saw you. Okay. You go find him. I think this last bill will take a little longer, so we'll wait just a minute if we can find him. All right, dear Representative Hackbarth is not here, so we will move on down the agenda to House File 896. But there's a Hackbarth amendment, or is it an author's amendment? So, here he is, right here. All right, so we will go ahead. House File 657 is before us. Representative Hackbarth makes the motion for possible layover and inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Hackbarth, the House File 657.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this does have to do with rules. I don't know if it's going to have to go somewhere other than holding it over.
Well, if we're going to lay the, Representative Hackbarth, if we lay the bill over, then the entire, and include it in the bill itself will have to go to other stops.
I understand. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That would be my motion then. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to bring the folks up that brought this bill to me, Minnesota Dark Calls and Anglers Association, and folks from that. They brought the bill to me. If you've got the House research summary, pretty much spells out exactly what the bill does. In rule, there's eight lakes that ban spear fishing, and we want to remove those eight lakes from that ban. And here today, I have a couple of folks from Minnesota Dark Calls and Anglers Association, and they'd like to explain the bill and why it's here, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speck, Mr. Gashel, thank you for coming, and if you'll introduce yourself before your testimony for the committee, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Roger Gashel. I'm with the Dark Calls Association of Minnesota. The reason that we brought this bill forward is we would like to have those lakes back to the people of Minnesota, for the fishermen of Minnesota. In Minnesota, we have these eight lakes are scattered throughout the state, and it's really what it is pure discrimination against our method of fishing. One of the things that, a couple ways, what we're looking for is to be able to go back on those lakes and take some fish home to eat. What happens when you go out fishing and you're trolling or whatever, and you get a fish on, and it's something that maybe it's too big or too small, you have to throw it back. Many times that fish will die. There's another method of fishing called with tip-ups, where you drill a hole in the ice, you put your bait down, and you have this little spring, and when a fish takes it and runs, you sit there, and when he swallows it, the flag goes up, you go and pull him in. If he's too big over the size limit for that lake, or he's too small, you take it out, throw him back, and in most cases, he dies. Our method of dark house spearing, as a lot of you know, we cut a hole in the ice, probably 2 feet by 3 feet, and we put a shelter over that, and we have a decoy that most of us carve, or we purchase them through the bait shops, and we put that down, and we swim it around hoping to attract the northern pike to come in, or rough fish. And our method then is we see that fish, and we can pretty much tell he's way too big or he's too small. We let him go. We like the fish that are in the limit where we can take home and feed our family, a 2, 3, 4 pound fish. So that's what we're doing. That's what we do, and we enjoy that. We don't kill fish that we don't want. So that helps save the fish in there. Like I said, it's discrimination when we can't go out and fish on a lake. Maybe that's a mile from our house or 5 miles. And there are 100-plus lakes in the state of Minnesota where we can't go on because of the restrictions. And we're working with that. And we came up, and that was a good number, to try to make the fish in those lakes bigger. I'll talk about that in a minute. But again, these lakes are spread over the state. There's two that are in the same county. What it would do to those lakes, probably nothing. As far as ruining the lake for this or that, we take just like anybody else. So again, it's just basic discrimination as far as we see. The lakes, how they were closed in the first place, there was a period of time when an organization and some of the people in the Department of Natural Resources did not appreciate dark house spearing. However, there was probably half the people in the department that enjoyed spearing. I heard from them. They would tell me, we love spearing. Keep up your work so that we can go spear. So that's what we're doing. So, and then one of the lakes that I wanted to mention and how these bodies of water, some of them were put there, well, we're going to make the fish grow bigger and so on. Cass Lake is a lake that was closed for over 20 years. And the studies that were done before before those 20 years really showed nothing of a growth pattern in that lake. Last year, with the help of a couple people in this room, on this committee, helped open that lake. What it did for the city up there at Cass Lake was astounding. The economy revived. There was joy. People were making money. They were having parties saying that we're making money, the resorts are, and everything was happy. It was a miracle what happened up there. And I think some people here may want to talk about that. What happened was all of these giant fish that were supposed to be in there weren't. The lake hadn't, over 45 years, had not really done anything because we weren't on there. So the average fish that we took out of their home to eat was 2 to 3, 4 pounds. That's it. And one of the fellows from up there in the fisheries said, well, it's kind of what we expected. Well, we were led to believe, and the people of Minnesota were led to believe, that, oh, this is a great trophy lake, when in fact, it really wasn't. So it opened up. The economy of that city up there boomed, and it was great for everybody. We enjoyed it, and I think we need, for these 8 lakes that were put on in one block, just at one swoop back in 10 years ago, well, we're going to close these lakes. Boom, 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 written off. That was one block. And what we're trying to do is just take that block back and give it back to the people of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tim Spreck. I'm president of the Minnesota Dark House Angling Association. I'm here today to make a case for opening these 8 lakes, and I'll try not to be treading any ground that Roger's already plowed. But historically, the problem that dark house spear fishermen have had with the DNR is that there's been a bias against spear fishing. And we're led to believe that that is starting to change now, and they're actually willing to talk to us. But the problem that we've had in the past is that we have to keep moving full speed ahead, because if we don't, it'll get bogged down in the quagmire that happens to be the DNR. Mm-hmm. So We're here today to make a case for removing regulations on these eight lakes and allowing the people of Minnesota to have back what they deserve. Keep in mind that spearing is allowed on many lakes that also have muskie in, and because these lakes are designated as muskie lakes, we've been told that we're not allowed on them, and the reasoning behind that was that we were going to indiscriminately kill muskie. It's been proven over years that that just simply is not the case. In the 10 years of data that we're able to have access to, we found absolutely no citations written for any spearing-related illegal activity that involved muskie. It just doesn't happen, folks. So let's get these lakes reopened. Now that we have this data on our side, we've been confronted with a new argument out of the blue saying, well, now you're going to kill all the large northern pike. That also is not the case. It's another trumped-up argument to keep us off the lake and continue discrimination against a class of people that's been downtrodden and generally not very good at making their case and don't understand the system. But Roger and I are here today, and many of you know us personally, and we've appeared before this committee many times over the years. And with the help of people like Representative Hackbarth and Representative Purcell, who have carried bills for us, we've been allowed to make our case, and we've been very successful in returning these lakes back to the people of Minnesota that own them. So let's not forget about the food fishermen. The propensity to manage large bodies of water in Minnesota for trophy status is a hand that's been greatly overplayed by the DNR. The idea that we can produce large fish in a majority of these lakes just is, number one, is not the case, and number two, it's not what the people of Minnesota want. What we want, as your average run-of-the-mill, blue-collar, hard-working people, is a nice 4 to 5 to 6 pound fish that we can put on the table and feed our family. So keep in mind there's no documented illegal spearing of muskie. Cass Lake and French Lake, which are two lakes that were opened within the last, I believe, 4 years on French Lake and 2 years on Cass, no illegal spearing activity, no spearing-related citations have been written. And then also some additional information about the recently completed survey on Cass Lake regarding spearfishing. And we originally looked at this as a potential witch hunt, trying to find something that we were doing wrong, and in fact it came out fairly favorable to our people. Harvest rates on Cass were about what was expected. Average size taken, 3 to 4 pounds. Harvest rates were well below the state averages for these bodies of water, and spear fishermen actually passed on 55% of the fish that they saw come into the hole. So we're conservation-minded. Most of our people are afraid to death of making a mistake because the penalties are so great, and the stigma would be, I mean, it would be reported in all the newspapers because the outdoor media generally has had an axe to grind against spearfishing for the better part of the last 2.5 decades. So our people are very cautious and very careful. And the economic benefits far outweigh any potential damage that could be done. And spearfishing is probably the fastest growing method of angling in the state. In the last license buying cycle, license sales were up 20%. It's a great way to have a historically important tradition that you can pass on to your family, and the young people are taking this up in droves. So let's give these people opportunity to get their children and grandchildren out on the lake, show them a historically important sport, and let's move forward with this because it's very important to the people of Minnesota. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Getchell, Mr. Speck. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to speak in favor. And just to follow up a little bit on the experience in my backyard there in my district on Cass Lake, and when that was opened up for spearing again. You know that I'm not aware of any problems. First of all, that and I, you know, that what you said is in line with what I've been given to understand from both the state conservation officers and the tribal conservation officers there on Leech Lake Reservation, and a couple of the resorters and a couple of the bait shops right there in Cass Lake did. I mean, if you go talk to them, if you talk about spearing on Cass Lake, they smile pretty big. And it's because they redeveloped some business and some significant business around Spearing, putting houses out on the lake there, and people came, like you say, and young people are, I mean, there's probably young people coming into Spearfish that may not even use a, you know, a hook and line. And so I think it is a, you know, we're all concerned about, are we going to get young people into outdoor activities, and Lord knows we need to. So this is something we, you know, I'm real supportive of this, and thank you, Representative Hackbarth, for letting me on that bill.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anybody else here who can speak to the history of this and the restricting of spearfishing in the past?
Well, we're going to get to that.
Wonderful. Then I will hold my comments.
Yeah. Okay, but we're going to go ahead with questions and answers for the testifiers or the author at this time, and then we'll call down the DNR as well as Mr. Ness wants to come forward at the very minimum.
Great.
Okay, questions from the members? Being none, Mr. Ness.
Good job. Thanks. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lance Ness, president of Anglers for Habitat and the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance. Mr. Chairman, we're neither for nor against the bill. We just were kind of caught off guard by it a little bit. It wasn't discussed at the round table. And we have some other changes that we're thinking about, we're vetting, as they say, as well about Northern Pike. So we just like some more time to think and contemplate this and speak both with the groups that you just heard from, as well as other angling and fishing groups about this situation. Maybe it's perhaps time to take a good hard look at all the DNR regulations regarding some of the angling species. So with that, Mr. Chairman, we'll keep it short.
Questions for Mr. Ness? Being none. The department, do you have someone here that can answer some questions? Mr. Doug Carlos?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, Kathy Don Carlos, Division of Fish and Wildlife Deputy Director. And I'd like to just make a few introductory comments and then turn it over to Dirk Peterson. But we just met with Representative Hackbarth this morning and about this particular bill, and relate to him that our fisheries managers are looking at some 25 lakes that have spearing restrictions right now. They've taken a really accelerated approach to the review. They would like to sit down with the stakeholder groups that have interests in these lakes to have discussions and make final recommendations. So, as far as the specific eight lakes in this bill, generally the fisheries managers are supportive of most of them, but do have concerns about one or two. But we would propose that we be given the time to have this accelerated review with both sides before the bill is finalized. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Dirk Peterson.
Mr. Peterson, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Dirk Peterson, DNR Fisheries. I just want to give a little brief context on why spearing bans, and then give the recommendation for the eight lakes that are part of this subpart of the rule. You know, spearing ban, well, let's see, initially musky fishing was considered to be one of the true trophy species found in Minnesota. But if you go back in time, up until about the 80s, most fisheries were harvest fisheries. And when you got into the 60s or 70s, you started to see people catch and release and value muskies. You saw this happen with trout. Trout anglers, musky anglers have kind of been the leading edge of conserving larger fish and using catch and release as a tool. The second thing that occurred was that we were trying to expand musky fishing opportunities. It was very difficult to get eggs, learn how to raise them, until we found the Shupak Lake up on in Voyageurs National Park. It was easily accessible for us, and we started raising that strain of fish. It turned out that strain never had the growth potential of the Leech Lake strain or the strains that are found in the headwater lakes, including Cass. And so for many years, we had a strain of fish out there that did not perform like we had hoped it would, and it had colorations and marks that were probably closer to northern pike and achieved the same growth profile as northern pike. And there were concerns that there would be incidental spearing, not intentional, but incidental. And so back in the 60s and in the 70s is when there was an effort to put a spearing ban on those lakes that were expansion opportunities for muskie angling. Now, as catch and release has improved, it didn't hit walleye fishing until the 80s. And even then, you know, it's probably a 50-50 split as to when you're a walleye angler, whether catch and release is desirable or if you really want to just take one home to eat or several. But anyway, a brief context there. And, you know, currently anglers and spearers, I would say, value muskies and for the growth potential they achieve. In the late 70s, we learned how to finally trap and take eggs and milk from muskie on Leech Lake. And we found out they had the superior genetics and had the growth potential. So we switched over to raising those fish. They get to be much larger. You now hear about fish being caught in the mid-50s in length. And they have different coloration, and they're not easily confused or anything of that nature. When we get down to the eight lakes that are in question here, most of these lakes were designated spearing ban lakes from 1968, mostly up till, I'd say in the late 70s, there's one in 87. So these are very old regulations that fit their time and place in history. They've probably become outdated because of higher values and recognition of all species and interests that are on the lake. I think Mr. Geschel and Mr. Spreck highlighted they pass on a lot of fish and are careful as they spear. We don't doubt that. Anyway, so we've done some review of these lakes in anticipation of this bill, and we think at least seven of them, probably they are outdated, and these are regulations that can probably be dropped. But as Deputy Director Kathy Don Carlos indicated, we are in the midst of a review. We have shared the fact that we are in the middle of this review with the other testifiers here. So it's not a secret that we're doing that for the Spearing Dark House Association. Kathy, or Deputy Director Don Carlos, indicated that there is one lake where the area manager would certainly like to consider delaying or at least holding off on removing a spearing ban, which is Baby Lake, one of the eight. And this is a lake where we've got shoepack fish growing. We'd like to check on the genetics and make a management plan to ultimately switch over to Leech Lake. And during that transition, the area supervisor would like to at least maintain the ban there. Is that critical to the future management of this lake? Maybe not, but it was a request to the area supervisor. So in summary, we've looked at these eight lakes. We think seven of them probably can be reasonably removed without any concerns or detriment. There's one where a supervisor would like to hold on to it for a while as he considers future management plans to transition to a better species or a better strain of muskies.
Representative Isaacson.
I think that most of the questions were answered in this part of the testimony. Is there going to be a change in the direction it's headed?
Well, I was just going to have questions first and then
see
how that goes. Further questions right. by the member.
I just wanted to say that I you know, in general, will just not support an expansion of spearfishing, so I would not be voting for this bill.
Other questions by the members? One moment, I got to ask a question here. All right, any other further questions? Representative Hansen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, I kind of feel this is a boomerang issue that comes back every year.
Mm-hmm.
I keep wondering, and I like all the folks on all the sides. But it keeps coming back year after year. Whatever we do this year, it'll be back next year. And I'm wondering why we can't just all get along on this. I mean, I just don't understand why we can't figure out why does it take a bill to get folks to talk to each other to figure out ones that could be taken off the list and
which ones need to come on the list, and you know, I'm sure we'll be back and voting on this again. So I would hope that at some point the interest groups would lay down their arms and talk to each other and find out some solution or compromise on these issues, because they keep coming back year after year. I'm sure we'll have another one next year, whatever we do. And
kind of like scopes on muzzleloaders.
It's like,
or Sam Hansen.
It comes back. It just keeps coming back. And so, I would hope that we could have folks work on this.
Sam McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, I think my question is for the DNR, but it might be for Representative Hackbart. We did a deal a year or two ago on put the number of lakes that allow, or that was that the number they could limit where spearing was? And then how is this affected? If we pick these lakes out, does that affect that legislation, or would this potentially, now would you impose some limitations on lakes that you currently don't have? How does this just identify a list of the ones that can't be on the 100?
Ms. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, you know, the spearing ban is largely a muskie regulation, and it was designed to prevent incidental spearing of muskie, and it's a regulation from 40, 50 years ago, or a tool used to manage for muskie. The effective tool for managing quality-sized northern pike has been the protected slot limit. And so 2 years ago, the Dark Horse Association wanted a limitation on the number of lakes that we would put a slot limit for northern pike to manage for quality-sized northern pike. And that was the result of that legislation. That's our most effective tool for providing quality northern pike fishing opportunities. It is not the spearing ban that gives us that quality northern pike opportunity. Northern pike will benefit from it, but it's not our best tool.
Representative McNamara, further questions?
No, I'm confused. Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
And Mr. Chair, members, I think the best way to resolve it is to move it on to another committee and put the pressure on. And so I'm going to vote for it if you want to send it to GovOps or wherever.
Well, actually, I heard the department say that they were that they were okay with 7 of the 8 lakes. So, my one moment. So, Representative Hackbarth amends his motion to send the bill, House File 657, to the General Register. At that point, we'll hold, you guys can work out that 8th lake, and Representative Hackbarth can bring forth an amendment, either deleting it or leaving it in, or he can inform us that you've worked it out. So that is the motion Representative Hackbarth has. Any questions on the motion? In favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Motion prevail. Thank you. All right. House File 896. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 896.
And that move would be to Representative Bouguinius's committee, the Environment, Natural Resources, Agricultural Finance Committee.
Thank you.
Representative Purcell, do you want to explain the bill? I think everybody in the committee knows what's going on here. What I'd like to do, if I could have your indulgence, is have the DNR come down and tell us what they're doing.
Please.
I think I know the will of this committee, and then we'll go from there.
Thank you.
Mr. Meyer?
Thank you.
Mr. Meyer, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources.
We have the bill before us, House File 896, and I think that everyone is aware of what the bill does. We'd like to hear what you're doing since the CARP Summit. I call it a CARP Summit. When we got together with the governor, there were a lot of stakeholders, members of the House and Senate there, and what it is that you're planning to do since that, before we continue on with action on this bill.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. For at the CARP Summit, there was a lot of discussion about the bar engineering report, which we've talked about in this committee. And all, it, actually, some of it was kind of a replay of what we've actually had in this committee as far as testimony from bar engineering, Jeff Griffin from G-Cube, talking about the Smith Root technology. At that point in time, Commissioner Landwehr and the governor also talked about how this is a problem for the state. It's not a DNR problem. It's not a legislature's problem. It's all of our problems that we're trying to deal with. And we talked about the next steps. And at that point in that meeting, Commissioner Landwehr did advise folks that we are going to progress into working with Smith Root to try to evaluate their sweeping technology to see if the Corps would permit that through a 408 process. It's a very complicated process, the 408 process, so we would probably be working with bar engineering to assist us through that 408 permitting process. But at this point in time, we're working with the Department of Administration to try to develop a sole source contract to get Smith Root to design the sweeping technology to be presented to the Corps for possible permitting. That lock and dam one.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. And so I think you hit the crux of the question, that the contract is not going to be issued to Mr. Griffin, who has testified before us and to testify before the summit, my word, summit. It'll be issued to the manufacturer of a technology. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding.
Okay. And how soon, Mr. Meyer, do you suspect that there would be action taken on that?
Mr. Chairman, we're doing everything we can to expedite that. There was also discussion at the CARP Summit that we have missed another construction season, more than likely. Our initial goal, when we were talking about this last legislative session, was to get cofferdam constructed or some kind of construction taking place at the end of this shipping season. Possibly depending on the timing of that design in the 408 permitting process, we may get there. From what I hear, I think it's very unlikely. But we want to get the contract done as soon as we possibly can. There's steps in law that we have to take, verifying a sole source vendor and then moving that contract forward. Until that contract is signed, any work that is done is not reimbursable. So we can't pay for any work that's done till that point in time. There's also an issue of, Mr. Chairman, the proprietary nature of the design documents of the lock. Those are federal top secret, I don't want to say top secret, but top security documents talking about the design of a federal facility. So there's issues that need to be dealt with there before those plans can be released and so forth.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been really on top of this the best we can and trying to move this along. And what I don't think I have in my mind, and maybe we've discussed this, is what is the timeline that we need to expedite this by versus what we're being told by the DNR?
Mr. Representative Isaacson, Mr. Chairman, yes. Well, I think the time is of the essence, and we've been doing this for a year and a half, and it's always been time is of the essence. And, you know, there's proposals out there to close the lock and dam, but I don't think that we can bet on one card.
Right.
And we have to do what we can do. That's a federal issue. You can support it one way or the other, however you feel about it. And as far as the Klobuchar bill and others, but we have to do what we have to do. And I felt that at the CARP summit that it was just obvious that we needed to have all the stones turned over before we go ahead. Representative Isaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm in complete agreement with you, and I'm just wondering, only because I don't understand necessarily the process you go through in the DNR, is there something we can do to expedite that? And I don't know if that's a question to you or the chair, to expedite, to speed that process up so we haven't lost the construction season, or is that literally just a matter of timing? There's no way around that.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Isaacs, the contract will be executed as fast as we possibly can.
Sure.
I have no idea how long it will take the contractor to develop those documents. I don't know how much it's going to cost. You know, we need to go through the 408 permitting process with the Corps. I don't know if the Corps will even permit it after we do that. So we are continuing at all levels trying to talk about what do we do. Do we put a barrier up? Do we close the lock and dam? You know, this is just another piece of the puzzle. So we are trying to get those documents prepared to present them to the Corps and then try to expedite. The Corps has said they will expedite right. that decision. You know, it's a pretty complicated process, and they think they can get it done within 6 months time frame to their review. But again, it's they don't know what we're presenting to them. We don't know what the design parameters are. So there's a lot of questions that are unknown at this point in time.
Representative Isaac, okay. Further. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, from everything I have heard from the Corps, they are not going to protect permit an electric barrier at this lock and dam. They're just not going to do it. So what makes you think that the Corps would actually permit an electric lock and dam or an electric barrier that's never been tested and never been used under these circumstances?
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, I am not an engineer by any way, shape, or form. There was testimony that you've heard in this committee and at that CARP summit about the differences between the technology that was evaluated in the bar report that was a constant on or a continuous field of electrical current versus this. The language in the bill talks in the amendment, sweeping or active field barrier with sonar capability. I mean, from what was presented to this committee and at the CARP summit, I think has led people to believe that this is a possibility. I'm not saying that it is a possibility or not, but this is an alternative technology that was not evaluated under the bar report because it was not presented to our contractor at the time when we asked Smith Root for the technology available at the current time. So that's the best I can answer that question.
At the same CARP summit, for members who weren't there, Dr. Peter Sorensen said that there has been no study of electricity and Asian carp. We have no idea what their reaction is going to be to an electric barrier with low electricity. We just don't know. It seems to me that we are going down a path without having done our due diligence on two counts and misleading Minnesotans to thinking that we're actually doing something when I'm afraid we are giving a lot of money to a very aggressive vendor with no expectation that we will get an end product that will be approved by the Corps. I am very troubled by this. I mean, this has been a lobbying frenzy rather than a science frenzy or an engineering frenzy. So I'm very troubled by this. But starting with Dr. Sorensen, who said, we have no idea. And I think if I could say it correctly, and other people were there who might correct me, we know something about common carp. They're bottom feeders. They're kind of slow moving. We know a lot about them. But Asian carp are totally different. They're not bottom feeders. They go up like this. They're extraordinarily strong. We have no idea whether they can be deflected by electricity or not. And we particularly don't have any idea where the young small ones can be deflected by electricity. And as this was sold to us, this is a low amount of electricity. And we don't know how these fish are going to react to a low amount of electricity. We are not doing our due diligence here. very troubling to me.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd have to disagree with Representative Agunias on several counts. First, I don't feel like this has been a lobbying job to us. If anything, I felt like we had to come back to this tooth and nail, that the lobbying job was on the bubbler, which had proven not to work. That had been my experience in this committee. So I don't see this as something where we're getting hard pressed on that, at least not from my perspective. Second, it was quite clear, just short of quoting the colonel that we had met with from the Corps, that they said if we could create a program that fit within their specs, that's something that they would look at allowing. So it was never a situation where we were given the intention from the colonel at the Corps, who said those specific words to us, and I asked him to repeat on several occasions just to make sure I was clear about that. But you are saying to me right now, if we come up with a program that works within their specs, you would be comfortable putting that in, and they said that was something they would consider and look at it and possibly do. So I think on those two fronts, I'd have to disagree with you. And the last part, and someone would need to correct me if I'm wrong, when we had originally heard from not Barr, but the other engineering firm, my understanding was is that they had indeed done some work themselves on Asian Cup. Is that not correct? Am I wrong about that part?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, could you restate that question? I'm sorry.
My understanding was with the new technology they had spoke about, they had actually done some research with Asian Carp. Is that not correct?
Right. Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to speak for the contractor.
Right.
All I know is this technology is still considered experimental.
Sure.
There are no barriers constructed anywhere in the world that Asian Carp are actively challenging it on a daily basis.
Okay.
So I think Representative Vaginius's point is something we need to consider as well. We need to try to figure out, will this work? And I don't know if we have those answers or not. I'm not going to sit here and try to say we do or we don't, because I don't know. So
okay. And so, thank you. And so, when we're talking about, for sure there has to be some due diligence and some work that needs to be done to make sure that the barrier actually does what it says it's going to do. Right, and that would and correct me if I'm wrong, but that's where I would assume part of what the putting that proposal together would involve. Would that be an incorrect assumption, Mr. Chair?
Well, Representative Isaacson, I think when it's presented, that there'll be, right now, as I understand it, the vendor can't answer the questions that the DNR has asked because they haven't seen the design of the lock or dam.
Correct.
And until that happens, and they can do at least a preliminary design, we have a lot of things that are unknown.
Right.
And I guess I can't give a definitive answer, but I think that what I do know is true is that this is something that has not been looked at.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with your assessment on the Corps when we met. They did not say they wouldn't allow it.
Right.
They said that they have specifications and that the design and operation will have to meet their specifications.
Correct.
They didn't say they would approve it.
Right.
They just said that any design would have to meet their operations and specifications. Beyond that, we are dealing with something that there are unknowns, but I don't think that the answer in the Barr engineering report was enough answer to the unknown that we wouldn't move forward with something along this line. I want to remind the members that it sounds as if Representative Wagenius is against the provisions, and I know that Representative Hackbarth has an amendment that we are going to be looking at in a few minutes. I doubt that will change Representative Wagenius's opinion on the bill, but the bill is being referred to her committee. ultimately she will have control of the bill once it leaves this jurisdiction, and so I want to make that clear. We have any further?
That's fine.
Okay, Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Isaacson, I think you're referring to the Smith Root Report, which I have here. Mm. And I think it's a very, very good report. Smith Root has spent 25 years installing electronic fish barriers all over the world. So it's certainly not a new company, and they've developed their technology quite well. Their most recent electronic barrier installation was in Norway, and that is the one that's very similar to the one that they're proposing in Lock and Dam number one. And
if I recall correctly, we did have some concerns about safety, the electronic barriers, and they've addressed that in this report. And Mr. Meyer, I'm sure you must have this report too, but I'll give you my copy. I would just like to conclude with a couple of comments, and one is, I guess we're not in a perfect world here, but we are facing a crisis, and I, for one, am not prepared to wait for the feds to do anything, because feds don't do anything well most of the time. So this is a six, according to Smith Root, this is about a $5 million installation, where the air bubble or strobe light would be about a $12 million installation. So $5 million to protect a multi-billion dollar industry in northern Minnesota with fishing and boating and everything else. Life's a gamble. Sometimes you take a little bit, you roll the dice. But I think this report does answer a lot of questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ugel. Representative Hackbart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if you want to do the amendment now or...
Well, we've got a couple of... why don't we hear from a couple more people and then we'll move
to that. I'll pass until we get to that.
All right. Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good night. Just have a question about, and I'm sorry, I have not read the Smith Root study, so I probably shouldn't be asking the question, but maybe someone would help me. You know, looking at the bubble technology, and Mr. Chairman, I'm glad that we chose not to go that route, since its effectiveness is not what we need at all. But I'm just wondering if Meyer, someone could tell me if we have a low energy or low wattage electric barrier in place, does it provide 100% reliability in stopping the movement of these?
Well, Representative Benson, I'm going to answer that question for Mr. Meyer, so it doesn't have to put him on the spot on that one. the contractor has said in this committee, well, let's put it this way, an engineer, not Smith Root, has said in this committee that the design will stop 100% of the carp. The question is will it?
Yeah.
Just like, for example, in the testimony that was given here, on the report that we received, it was 60 to 80%, as I recall, maybe 70 to 80% efficient on carp, but yet at the summit, it became 90%.
Yeah.
Well, so there's a lot of questions out there, and I think that this bill, what it could do is move forward. I think that the DNR is going to move forward, but we need to light a fire under them as well. If they would have had a press release tonight before this meeting that said they were going forward with this, we wouldn't have done this bill tonight and have this discussion again for the upteenth time.
Yeah.
But I don't think we can answer that question. I don't know that. I mean, that's you know, that's like I don't even know how to make an analogy on that.
May I just follow up, Mr. Chairman? Thank you for that. I'm just wondering, you know, when they come up with the 85 or the 90% or the 100%. Just to clarify, we're talking about a low or high energy electric barrier.
Well,
which is of the two, or is it both?
Representative Benson, I recall from the testimony at the CARP summit, and I also recall testimony in this committee, that it was significantly lower than what they had installed in the Illinois River, to the extent that it almost seemed trivial. 5,000 volts versus somewhere down in the low 100s, as I recall. Again, it may be that in the process of designing this design, once they get the lock and dam specifications, if they ever do, that they might have to have more electricity than they anticipated or less. Now, I kind of doubt it's less, but, I mean, we don't know until those questions are answered.
Mr. Chairman, and then if it turns out they need higher energy, then would we not again have difficulties with CORE?
Representative Benson, we probably would, but the probably is the key word. We don't know until we get there. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it's true that we don't have any data on Asian carp, And I don't know very much about carp, but I'm going to take Representative Wagenius' word for it that they behave quite differently than other carp. It would, if I were the engineer that was going to do this, I'd want to know if there are any large differences in the behavior of Asian carp relative to electric barriers compared to other fish. And since there doesn't seem to be any shortage of Asian carp, it ought to be possible for a very small-scale, short, not particularly scientific test to be done of such a concept and find out if an electric barrier actually will stop an Asian carp of a couple of different sizes, because we're worried about the big ones and the little ones, really. The medium ones, you know, if you can get the two ends, you'll get the medium ones. But as an engineer, which I am, I wouldn't be comfortable going forward with a big expense on an important problem if I didn't know the answer to that question. Thank you.
And Representative Russo, I get what you're saying. The problem is that the solution that's been presented is somewhere between 60 and 90% efficient, or effective, I should say. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Can I direct it at Representative Purcell? Can I direct my question to Representative Purcell?
Absolutely.
Representative Purcell, given, I think, one point of Representative Wagenius's statements that I would echo or agree with, and you'll be saying here, if I quote this correctly, the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall install electric fish barriers using the most modern technology available for fish dispersal systems to address the imminent. And so the idea of this modern technology available for fish dispersal systems, you know, is there a way to amend or make it clear that part of our expectation in designing this is that there is a testing phase that occurs, maybe one not as scientific as Representative Russo suggested, but something that demonstrates to us that we have a confidence in that? I guess for me, when I heard this bill, and that's probably the danger of being a freshman, so I'll own that right now, is I kind of assumed that was a part of this process, right? So when Representative Wagenius brought that up, at first I was like, well, of course they are, and then as we thought about it, oh, that makes sense that maybe we can assume that. So do you kind of see what I'm saying? Is there a way to add that in there? We don't have to do it now, we could do it in another committee, but I think that'd be something that would give a lot of confidence to folks that are, you know, uncertain, because it doesn't make sense if we don't know for sure. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think it's a good point, and Representative Russo and Representative Wagenius, I think we can move ahead, and let me just say the commitment I believe that we all share is that we aren't going to wait another year before we do something. And so if we are to get this thing amended the way it should be now and then move to Environment Finance Committee, perhaps, I'm just thinking out loud here, and maybe take some of the funds that are available and have Peter Sorensen or somebody over to you do something. I mean, I assume that they have tanks that are somewhat readily available to do this kind of thing, and we can get some science on this stuff. But this is pretty new stuff coming at us. But let's don't wait and be talking about this a year from now right here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Meyer. And I want to, in both the bill and the impending amendment, it talks about the commissioner shall award, the commissioner shall enter into contracts. And you mentioned a sole source contract and potentially a very large sole source contract. What are the procedures for a sole source contract? And what if the whatever vendor is getting a sole source contract and they are making claims to a committee about the efficacy of their product and, oops, didn't work. So is there a way to recover? What's the liability? I mean, we've had vendors making claims for 14 months on this, on all sides. So if we're going to enter into a sole source contract, one, what is the protection for the public in terms of insurance or liability that it does what it says it does? And then secondly, I think this is a little bit implied in the next amendment, or in the amendment, is if we enter into a sole source contract for the design on this lock, is that obligating the state for entering into any electric barrier with the same vendor that's selected for this sole source contract?
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chairman?
Hang on one second. Right now, we're a little bit far broad afield. So what I want to do is I want to adopt the Hackmarth Amendment so we can talk specifically about that amendment and not be so broad afield. Representative Hackmarth moves the DE3 amendment to House File 896. In favor of the amendment, say aye.
Before we take that vote, I would like to delete Section 2 from the amendment. I'd like to incorporate that in my amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay,
delete
does
Section
anyone
2.
Have a question on the amendment to the amendment?
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a question on the overall amendment. I can wait till this part's done.
All right. Any questions on the amendment, Representative Representative Fabian?
This is to the author, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative Hackmarth, on line 1.5, it says electric fish barrier using the most modern technology.
Are we on the amendment to the amendment, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Yes.
We're just deleting Section 2.
I got that. I understand that.
Okay.
But go ahead, Representative.
Just for point of clarification, okay, or whatever it would be, on line 1.5,
right,
it says using a fish barrier using the most modern technology available. Just to create a little more flexibility there, would it be more effective to use best or most effective rather than most modern?
No.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair and That's committee members, I think either or, I mean, effective gets at, like, the purpose, so that might be a better term. But
Representative Hackbart.
I don't have an opinion, Mr. Chairman.
All right, so on the motion to amend the amendment, or no, let's to delete Section 2 of the DE3 amendment to House File 896. In favor of deleting 2, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, to the motion, DE2 as amended, 3 as amended. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you.
One moment. Oh.
I want an answer.
Yes, we're going back to the answer now. And I want to remind the members, and now it says, to enter into a contract to design.
We haven't passed the amendment, have we?
Not build.
Point of interest, we passed the amendment without.
We passed the amendment to the amendment. So now we need to, thank you very much, we need to adopt.
We're on the discussion of the amendment, right? And that's what I had a question about, sir.
Yes, discussion on the amendment. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chair. Chairman, I just had a question as to why we switched this over, and no one's explained that, and I just want to understand why we took a bunch of parts out and got so specific on just one area.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Isaacson, we want to get to the heart of the issue. Mm-hmm. The problem is that we can't move forward to look at all the intricacies of an electric fish barrier at Lock and Dam 1 unless we have a design. We have to have an engineering firm or somebody design it so we can find out if it's going to work. We can't present anything. We can't get any answers from the Corps of Engineers unless we have a design. So this amendment strictly goes to the point of let's get a design on the electric fish barrier so we can present it to the Corps of Engineers so we can get answers from the Corps of Engineers whether something like this can work in the lock at Lock and Dam 1. This is simply where we want to get. Can this possibly work there or not? And we won't get that until we have a design.
Thank you. That answers my question.
One moment, please. We're going to have to slow down slightly here because this is a really important issue. And so I need a motion to reconsider the former motion to amend the amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion prevails. Now, the amendment, Representative Hackbarth moves the DE3 amendment with striking Section 2. In favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion is adopted. Now to the DE3 amendment and Representative Isaacson. But we are going to get back to Representative Hansen next.
So,
because you had the floor originally.
Thank you. So just so I'm clear about what you're saying, we're really trying to get this to be focused on promoting that, or not promoting, but pushing the idea and moving that forward rather than scattering it out by being focused on this one thing. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Isaacson, where we want to get is we don't want to leave anything behind. We want to look at the electric fish barrier. We want to get all of the answers before we move forward.
Great.
And the only way we can do that is to have a design to get the answer from the Corps of Engineers and the Coast Guard, whether it's safe and if it can work in the lock and dam.
Thank you. That's perfect.
Okay, Representative Hansen, to your question, and now on the amendment for the contract to design.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Meyer, I think you remember the question.
Parts of it. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, you were asking about sole source contracting and basically holding that contractor's feet to the fire, the effectiveness of that contract. Sole sourcing contracting, I'm not a contract expert. The way I understand it, we go through a process with the Department of Administration that justifies that this vendor is the only person capable of doing that job. So, and in my understanding right now, there's only one system, or there's one company working on a system that deals with sweeping or active field barrier with sonar capable and being reconfigured into a graduated field fish barrier. So the language on lines 1.6 and 1.7 of the new language in the bill, I believe, gives us the justification where we should be able to do a sole source contract. That contract, to address your point about what if it's designed not to be effective, the contract could be written in such a way, and we would need to see if we could get it written in such a way that there would be some sort of penalty or clawback if the design failed to be effective. So there are examples of where that can take place. We would need to make sure that we could come up with some language that people, the vendor, or the contractee and the contractor would agree to. That could be a problem. I don't know if it would be a problem or not. We would have to try to adjust that, and I can get back to you more on what that language would look like into the future. But we need to look at that. And just let me put one thing on the table here that we also talked about last week at the summit. We had a discussion about leaving no rocks unturned, closing the lock, buying out the companies. We're trying to get all these rocks unturned, right? This rock is going to be about a $500,000 stone to turn over. So I want people to understand that this is not a cheap proposal, but going into this with our eyes wide open that we may be spending $500,000 just to get to know again. So, Mr. Chairman, I just needed to put that on the record as well as we're talking about this.
Well, Mr. Meyer, when you did the contract for the design, make sure I get this right, design with the other vendor that gave us the report, and they came forward, and did the DNR acquiesce to the fact that that barrier was not going to be 100% and ask for a design knowing that wasn't going to be 100%, and was there a clawback in that thing that you spent how much on? You met several questions in there.
Mr. Chair, I don't know the exact amount of that contract. I can get that for you. It was a two-part contract whereby they would carry forward the recommendations through the 408 permitting process, bar engineering. That the system that they laid out has not been designed. We have not designed anything yet. That system, they evaluated the current technologies available, talked about the effectiveness, and when they talked with Smith Root about the current technologies available, they did not, for some reason, put this sweeping technology on the table at that discussion, which I believe occurred in the past 6 months. Had that occurred, we would have had that technology in the report. And I'm not going to sit here and say why or why not that happened. That's a discussion for our engineering to have with you all. But so there's been no design done. This is to get to that next step.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. So I think a clawback, whatever vendor you're using, particularly when we do a sole source one that has a precedent of being implemented on multiple millions of dollars of project, there needs to be some taxpayer protection here when we do the extraordinary sole sourcing.
All right, and now we have Representative Uglem first.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I'll withdraw.
Representative Isaacson.
I'm good.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hackbart, I think this is a really good amendment, and it does some really good things. I've got a few questions, Mr. Chair. First of all, this is not asking for a contract to build it. This is a contract to design it.
Right.
And this is fixing a shortcoming, and I think, Mr. Meyer, Director Meyer, you just alluded to it. 6 months ago, I don't know that this was a viable alternative. It is today. And I think at the summit, the commissioner and the governor wanted us to do just what this says. And I think we heard numbers of $500,000 or whatever, and hopefully it's substantially less than that if we're going to get to something that many of us in the room think is a possibility, and that's the Corps turning us down. But we need to see if there's a chance that this can work. So I like what this amendment does, Mr. Chair, and Representative Wagenius. I think this is a good amendment. This is right along the line with what the summit did. And maybe, Mr. Chair, I would ask if Representative Wagenius has a comment to that, then if I could come back to have the floor. I have some other questions. But I think, Representative Wagenius, this just does, this is saying to the DNR, probably through BAR, that why don't you look at this technology right now, not why don't you, do look at it. You might have to spend some significant amount of money, but let's take a look at it. I think that's what this is saying, and I think that's a really good idea. So if I could keep going, Mr. Chair.
Ben McNamara.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, Dr. Sorensen has alluded that he may have some new eDNA information in the next few weeks. Mr. Meyer, is there any reason for us to believe that we may get some information in the next few weeks that would help us know where the fish really are? Are you expecting, or do you have no idea?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I just know that those results from the testing that was done with samples last fall, I believe, will be out within the next several weeks. I don't know what those results are by any means.
Representative McNamara.
So, Mr. Chair, I think that means that unfortunately we may not know any more than we know now, and you don't know any more than we know now. And unfortunately, it may come back that we don't know if the eDNA was right or not, and that's too bad, but it is what it is. Mr. Meyer, can you get back to the committee on where we actually have found the four different species? I know recently there was one silver and three grass carp or whatever down by Winona, and if I'm not mistaken, a big head was found in Prescott in 09 or something. But could you give us again, and I know that I'm not saying right now, but if we could just know where they were found, when they were found, and the quantity of the northernmost reaches of the four different fish, that would be beneficial, Mr. Chair. And then if Mr. Meyer could just answer that, then I have a couple other quick ones.
Mr. Chairman, I can get you that. We also have readily available the maps of our eDNA results, but I'd rather wait, take that map, overlay Dr. Sorensen's newest results, and have that discussion at a separate time. So I can get you that list. That's not a problem.
All right.
Thank you.
We have to get into the public testimony on this, Mr. Diamond. And we have 10 minutes, members.
Mr. Chair, while he's coming up.
Representative Wagenius.
Members, you should know, and if I mistake that, somebody will correct me, but when we were at the CARP Summit, right at fairly early on in the CARP Summit, Commissioner Landwehr said that he could do this contract, he had the money, and he was ready to go. It was way late in the same summit that Dr. Sorensen spoke out and said, because it was not part of the conversation, said, you know, nobody knows about these carp and electricity. So just so people know, the DNR was planning to go ahead without legislative action.
Thank you. Ms. Diamond.
Tom Diamond. Representative Purcell and others who are working on
Purcell,
this issue.
Could you introduce yourself for the
sure.
record?
Sure. Tom Diamond.
And you represent who?
Just a public citizen.
Thank you.
I want to commend Representative Purcell and others who are working to make sure we have the most effective barrier. Failure to prevent the Asian carp to get past here should not be an option. One of the things that's going on is, as you're aware, the governor and the congressional delegation, we're working to get congressional authority to close the locks, which is a 100% solution. But as you also know, Congress is pretty much in gridlock right now. But there's another option on that table that I think people should be aware of. The Above the Falls plan that Minneapolis has developed will create 2,500 new riverfront housing units. It'll create 2,000 new net new jobs, and will provide a continuous riverfront trail
and parkway along the river. That plan has been approved by the city of Minneapolis, and is the city has committed to closing the port of Minneapolis, which they own, this year. So that leaves only two more barge facilities on that stretch of the river. If bonding authority can be provided, or other sources of funds can be provided, those two facilities could be removed off the river. That changes the requirement. No longer would the Corps of Engineers need to have congressional authority. If the barge facilities are moved off the river, the Corps of Engineers can close that without congressional authority. So that is moving along and is a real possibility. Like all these other possibilities, we don't exactly know what all will play out in the coming time. But I think it's really important that we consider this along with other possibilities, and that while we pursue all options to find out that what is our best option, that we don't ignore or preclude these options because we have locked ourselves into a fixed position until we know what all the possibilities are. This is a real possibility, but without knowing whether the Corps or other parties will prevent these other options, we should make sure that this option stays on the table for consideration with the rest of the options.
Thank you very much, Mr. Diamond and Mr. Ness.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lance Ness, president of Angler Habitat and the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance. I'll try to be brief, Mr. Chairman. I know that time is of the essence, as was just discussed. One thing I would like to make sure that, for the record, that we all know what's really at stake here. Just have a new report out by the outdoor recreation folks about the Minnesota's outdoor recreation generates. $11.6 billion in consumer spending. 118,000 jobs are related. $3.4 billion in wages. And $850 million in taxes generated by Minnesota alone just for the outdoor recreation. That's what's at stake. Moving on again, Mr. Chairman, the reason we support Representative Purcell's bill here is he's finally addressed one of the key parts here, and that's the Minnesota River, our namesake. There are no locks or dams on the Minnesota River. At some point, someone's going to have to address the Minnesota River. It is key to southern lakes. We have many, many lakes in southern Minnesota that are very, very valuable. And they're very, the southern fishermen are very concerned about the Minnesota River, as well as other rivers, the Root, Vermilion, Trout streams along the southeast. All these are in danger. But we can start to move ahead, and that's what I think what Representative Purcell bill does, and with Representative Haxberg's amendment, we can move ahead a little bit. But we should be thinking, again, all avenues, as was talked about, no rock should be left unturned. We should be looking at every conclusion. I will, for the sake of some of the new members of the committee, I've been around a long time. In 1991, I was president of Minnesota Waterfall Association. Through us, in partnership with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Minnesota DNR, Ducks Unlimited, built a carp barrier in Lake Heron. It was built by one of the vendors. To my knowledge, that has never been breached. No carp has ever passed that barrier. It's not a gigantic barrier, but it is one that could be studied. And I think there's a possibility. We have one right in our own backyard that we should take advantage of. And I'll just conclude, Mr. Chairman. I know that time is winding up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ness. Representative Hackbarth, and then they're going to be very short. We have 4 minutes.
Very, very short, Mr. Chairman. I would like to speak to that issue with Heron Lake. That is an electric barrier there, and it has not been breached. There's a couple other electric barriers in the state that we do have that are built to stop carp. And also the DNR, with the appropriation that we spent, that we obtained with that $7.5 million, has taken some of that money and put it down in Iowa at Lake Okoboji to help build an electric barrier to stop Asian carp down there. So it's not necessarily something that's not been done.
Okay, here's the course we're going to take. Representative Purcell is going to amend his motion to temporarily lay over the bill. In the amendment, the DE3 amendment, the appropriation was removed. That means it does not have to go to Representatives Wagenius's committee, and it can go directly to the General Register, in my estimation, because the DNR already has the money to do this. And so I'm going to have a consultation with Representative Wagenius before the meeting tomorrow night. We will take it up tomorrow night. We will ask for additional public testimony because we haven't given anyone other than those people who signed up. time to testify, and then we will take a vote on them. So Representative Purcell amends his motion to lay the bill over until tomorrow.
So moved.
Meeting adjourned.